This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the timber wars in the Northwest rage on. A federal judge finds the government did not follow the forest plan and has shut down some logging sales. EPA's Blue Ribbon panel says use less MTBE in gasoline. It may clean the air, but it poisons the water. It's the season to go to the beach. What beaches are clean, and what are the states that don't even bother to find out? And on the Earth calendar, conservation officials are counting ring-necked pheasants in Iowa. They're setting the guidelines for the hunting season this fall. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. There has been another skirmish in the ongoing timber wars in the Pacific Northwest. This time, Federal Judge William Dwyer has ruled that the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service did not comply with the forest plan, which was brokered in the first year of the Clinton administration. The plan permits logging on federal lands while protecting some ancient forests and wildlife like salmon and the spotted owl. The judge has blocked 9 timber sales from going forward, and his decision raises the question of whether many other scheduled sales are similarly illegal. Doug Hyken is Western Oregon field representative for the Oregon Natural Resources Council. He's one of the lawyers representing the environmental groups that sued to stop the sales.
Over the past decades, the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management were seriously overcutting our national forests. And that was proven with the decline of the spotted owl and the salmon and the many other species that live in our forest. When President Clinton came into office, he gave us a Northwest Forest Plan, which he promised would be a balance between logging and species protection. And they really did turn over a new leaf in some ways and protected a bunch of our forests. What this lawsuit was about was whether they were following those rules. And the result is the judge said that the agency was still acting unlawfully. They still haven't found the balance yet. They're putting timber harvest ahead of clean water and ahead of wildlife and ahead of our ancient forests. And I think it's a very significant victory that we're reminded that these resources are at stake and they're still not fully protected.
The judge found that before authorizing the timber sales, the Forest Service was obliged to take account of wildlife that would be affected. One species of concern was the red vole, a mouse-like creature which is prey for the spotted owl. Again, Doug Hyken.
The simple way you do that is you survey for the species, and once you know where they're located, then you can make adjustments to your logging plans. In this case, we showed that the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management were not doing those surveys. They were not looking for the species, and without knowing where they are, then they couldn't claim to be doing environmentally sensitive logging because they wouldn't have any idea of where to adjust their practices.
What the government timber sale managers did, and what the court found illegal, was they told their foresters that surveys of wildlife in the timber sale areas would not have to be done if a more general environmental assessment had been made. In strong disagreement with Judge Dwyer's ruling are the timber companies who are planning to cut the trees. Chris West is the vice president of the Northwest Forestry Association based in Portland, Oregon. His association represents companies that log on federal lands.
Part of every project planned by the federal agencies involves environmental impact statement or environmental analyses that thoroughly analyzes the consequences of different alternatives of proposed actions. And they've always done that and will continue to do that. What the judge has reinterpreted is to what extent those surveys are to be done and how they're to be done. And we just don't feel that that's the role of a federal judge to determine such site-specific scientific and resource management decisions. That should be left up to the agencies and the resource professionals. And the bottom line here is the judge didn't find that any environmental law had been violated. He's just reinterpreted a provision of a 600-page plan.
In proceedings before the court, one species that received particular attention was the red vole. The judge found that surveys of the vole had not been conducted, and such surveys were required by the plan. Rex Holloway, media specialist for the Pacific Northwest region of the Forest Service, says additional surveys were unnecessary. a position that environmentalists and the judge rejected.
What we did with the Red Vole is we surveyed literally thousands and thousands of acres, and what we found out is that they lived in certain areas within the forest above below a certain elevation, and or in between a certain elevation, and that we could begin to refocus where we did survey for these. So there's really not a need to go survey for voles in areas where after experience you find out that they don't need to live. So we felt like the plan was adapted, that as we learn more about species, we can adapt our surveys as well as how we manage for these areas.
Holloway also says that the Forest Service has not yet figured out how to survey for some species that might be affected by logging. He adds that additional timber sale contracts will not be awarded.
One of the problems that we're having with this specific part of the plan to survey and manage is some of the species that were talked about for needing to be surveyed, there's very little known about those species, and we're finding stuff out about them. And even developing a way to survey for these species, whether it be a certain time of the year, and some of them are only can be identified maybe every 1 to 3 years. That's been the difficulty.
This leaves the Clinton administration with a dilemma in the Northwest. The timber industry says it's not getting the logs it was promised under the agreement. The environmentalists say the government is still preoccupied with selling wood and has not fulfilled its obligation under the agreement to protect wildlife and the ecosystem. If the administration sticks by the Forest Service and appeals Judge Dwyer's decision, the appeal will take some time and may well fail, which will put logging operations on hold for some time. If it starts doing the wildlife surveys that Judge Dwyer says are required, that too will take time, and the service may not have money in its budget to get the work done. While the air you breathe is getting cleaner, the water you drink may be contaminated. It's the result of the gasoline additive methyl tertiary butyl ether. MTBE has been used to reduce harmful emissions from automobiles, but it's also contaminating groundwater supplies and possibly posing health risks to humans. In recent weeks, a Blue Ribbon panel recommended that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reduce the amounts of MTBE in gasoline. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
The 1990 Clean Air Act amendments called for the use of reformulated gasoline to reduce automobile emissions. As a result, MTBE is being added to gasoline, so tailpipe gases cause less pollution. But the additive is causing problems with groundwater supplies from Maine to California. And as a result, the U.S. EPA established a Blue Ribbon panel of scientists, industry representatives, and others to assess whether the benefits of MTBE outweigh the risks. Dan Greenbaum, president of the Health Effects Institute, a nonprofit research institute that does research on air pollution, and chairman of the Blue Ribbon Panel on MTBE, describes the panel's recommendations.
We called for, first, cleaning up and fixing up the underground storage tanks that are leaking around the country. And then secondly, because we didn't think that would be quite enough, we called for reducing substantially the use of MTBE and replacing it with things like ethanol and other components of crude oil that could make cleaner gasoline.
Not only does MTBE give drinking water an unpleasant taste and odor, it has been shown to cause cancer in some laboratory animals. Critics, on the other hand, say the evidence showing MTBE to be carcinogenic is inconclusive. Gas stations and other facilities were required to have underground tanks upgraded by December of last year. This leaves some wondering whether substantially reducing amounts of MTBE is necessary and whether Americans will see dirtier air. Terry Wigglesworth, is executive director of the Oxygenated Fuels Association, which represents producers of MTBE.
This action does not seem logical to me because we truly believe that the reason that gasoline has reached groundwater is because of underground storage tanks. And much of the data that the panel looked at was prior to a national program to fix underground storage tanks, which has been put in place during this last year. So we believe that once all of these measures are on the books and working, we will have cleaner groundwater because gasoline will be kept in the tanks where it belongs.
But Dan Greenbaum says it's not that simple.
About 20% of those tanks, that's 80,000 tanks, are still not upgraded to today's modern standards. And we even found some evidence that some of the new upgraded tanks were improperly installed and are still leaking.
The EPA's Blue Ribbon panel also determined that older two-stroke motorboat and jet ski engines are putting methyl tertiary butyl ether into waterways, especially during the summer months. As Dan Greenbaum mentioned, the panel also recommended that alternative additives be used in place of MTBE. Terry Wigglesworth questions that recommendation and says few alternatives provide the same benefits as MTBE, and if used, they could cause an increase in gas prices. Dan Greenbaum responds this way.
We looked at the price question and felt that as long as the refiners were given enough time to adjust their processes to build the additional capacity they needed, that there were ways to make the fuel without MTBE that would be about the same cost as gasoline is today. Some of them would use ethanol, particularly those in the Midwest. Others would probably use alkylates and aromatics, which are parts of fuel today, but they'd just use more of them.
In the past, EPA has supported the use of MTBE, but Dan Greenbaum says the agency is changing its stance and agreeing with the recommendations made by the Blue Ribbon panel. He says the EPA is not the only federal body that needs to take action.
Equally important, what has to happen now is that we felt that Congress needs to act to amend the law that established the Cleaner Burning Fuel Program in the first place in order to allow these other alternatives to MTBE to be used and to give the states and EPA the authority to oversee the reduction in the use of MTBE.
Greenbaum adds that the story of MTBE is one of unintended consequences and that the EPA needs to learn that a substance should be fully tested before it is introduced into public use. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Write us here at The Environment Show. The address is 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. This year's hot, dry summer season has many of us heading to the beach. But while the idea of cooling off in the ocean may be just what the doctor ordered, have you wondered about the quality of water your family may be splashing around in? The Environment Show's Leah Fleming reports on the good, the bad, and the ugly of America's ocean beaches.
It's on the agenda of many environmental groups right now. It's even of concern to many beachgoers. It's beach water. Recently, actor Ted Danson, president and founder of American Oceans Campaign, a national nonprofit organization, testified before the Senate in support of two beach bills that will improve beach water monitoring nationwide. And the Natural Resource Defense Council, the NRDC, released its 9th annual Vacation Beach Quality Guide, titled Testing the Waters, a guide to water quality at vacation beaches. The NRDC found that in 1998, there were over 7,000 beach closing and advisories at Ocean, Bay, Great Lakes, and some freshwater beaches. That's a 75% increase over 1997 levels, according to Sarah Chasis, senior attorney and director of the NRDC's Water and Coastal Program. Chasis says that increase is due to three factors.
Increased monitoring, increased reporting of closings, and there were very heavy rains associated with El Nino in Southern California that drove the California closings up significantly. So the good news is there is more monitoring and more reporting. That is an increasing trend over the years that we've observed. The bad news is that as there is more monitoring and reporting, we're seeing a more comprehensive picture of pollution around the country at our nation's beaches, and the major sources of that pollution are sewage overflows, sewage spills, and polluted stormwater.
Chasis says there are still major portions of the nation's coastline that are not routinely monitored for pollution or where there are no programs in place to alert the public of closed beaches.
For example, in Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Washington, and Oregon are not routinely monitored, or there are not programs in place to notify the public. And those are on NRDC's beach bum list this year. In addition, Panama City, Florida, which is a major beach resort destination, is on our beach bum list because that community does not routinely monitor or notify the public. The importance of monitoring is highlighted by the example of Key West, Florida. Key West, Florida, 2 years ago, was on our list of beach bums. Subsequently, they adopted a monitoring program which found contamination, and this year have issued a number of advisories. As a result, beachgoers are protected from swimming in polluted water. The same is true in other areas, including Myrtle Beach, Santa Barbara, California, beaches in North Carolina, where previously there were not monitoring programs. Now there are, and beachgoers have been warned when there is a pollution problem.
A beach on the NRDC's beach bum list does not mean that the water is polluted at every beach in that state or that there's even a pollution problem. The criteria for making the list is that the beach does not have any statewide system for routine monitoring to determine if there is a problem and to notify the public if there is one. On the same token, the NRDC also has a beach buddy list.
We've also identified a number of beaches which do a particularly good job of monitoring and notifying the public. And there are five this year. They are Cape May, New Jersey, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, which again previously was a beach bum, now it's a beach buddy, Old Orchard Beach in Maine, the North Carolina Outer Banks Ocean Beaches, and Warren Dunes in Michigan, which is on Lake Michigan. And those are all beaches that are monitored weekly, and the beach is closed or the public is notified whenever pollution levels exceed the health standards.
Now, the NRDC's report contains data from last year, but Chasis says the information is still serviceable to a beachgoer this year.
The data does tell about the monitoring practices that communities follow, and for the most part, those are going to be the same in 1999 as they are in 1998.
The NRDC offers many tips for finding out about a beach that you may want to go to in your area. Chasis says you can contact your local health department in the community to find out if monitoring is being done, and if not, why. You can also ask them whether there are known pollution sources that may affect beach water quality. The NRDC also offers information on 1,500 of the nation's beaches on its website at www.nrdc.org. But Chase says there are some general rules of thumb that you can follow to protect yourself in the water.
Beaches, open ocean beaches, where there's, you know, good circulation, water circulation, are less likely to be polluted than beaches on enclosed or semi-enclosed water bodies. Beaches where you don't have known sources of pollution affecting them are obviously going to be more, are going to be safer. You know, swimming in near developed areas, particularly those where there may be storm drains that empty onto the beach, swimming in those areas after a heavy rainstorm can be problematic, because that's when rain runs off the city streets or suburban streets and carries pollution into the ocean or into bays. So, for example, in many communities, there are advisories, standing advisories or advisories that are issued not to swim within 12 hours or 24 hours or 72 hours of a heavy rain.
Chase says if you really are concerned, though, you can always play it safe and keep your head above the water, because most illnesses are associated with having your head under the water. The NRDC says it is also important to note that they're not talking about life and death illnesses here. The most common are gastroenteritis, skin rashes, ear infections, and upper respiratory infections. And the most common symptoms are fever, nausea, vomiting, and stomach pain. But Chase says don't let that keep you away from the beach. Just be careful and enjoy. Reporting for the Environment Show, I'm Leah Fleming.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's the time of year when conservation officials in Iowa are counting ring-necked pheasants. Ross Harrison is chief of the Information and Education Bureau with Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. He says the surveys are conducted in the early morning hours when the pheasants can be found near roadsides collecting pebbles before they begin feeding. The birds swallow the rocks, which then enter their gizzards and are used in the digestion of food.
And during this time of the year, it's real predictable that a lot of the birds will be out on the roadsides. So we drive these 30-mile routes under certain wind conditions. Winds have to be less than like 10 miles an hour. And we set out, we estimate what the dew conditions are. And if everything's right, we'll run one of these 30-mile routes. We'll stop each mile and record observations of what we see and what we hear.
Harrison says surveyors count males, females, and any ring-necked pheasant chicks that can be seen.
We compile this information from about 100 different routes around the state. We tally it all up in our computers, and we have a program written just for this. It will show the comparison to last year. And we know this information is very accurate in terms of predicting whether the pheasant numbers will be up or down during the November, December, January hunting seasons. We know that this information is accurate from August because we can compare it with surveys of hunters that we take in January, and they show us on the surveys how many pheasants they harvested that year. We compare that back to our roadside counts from August. We see an extremely close statistical relationship between the number we counted and the number that hunters shoot. So we can tell hunters then in at the end of August, when we compile this information, how we expect the season to be.
Iowa is the number one state in the country for pheasant hunting, which brings a lot of hunters and dollars to local economies. Overall, Harrison says ringneck pheasant populations have remained stable during the time the surveys have been conducted. Hunters are only allowed to shoot the males, because one male will mate with several females, which gives the female the opportunity to lay 10 to 12 eggs a season. Hunters are limited to 3 a day, and last year, 1.3 million ringneck pheasants were taken. Harrison says they're about the size of a chicken with brown and green coloration and long tail feathers.
Their heads are a real dark iridescent green with a white outline, kind of a red rooster type of deal on the top, like a chicken almost, but not a comb that folds over. They have the green head, then it goes down to the neck where they have this very distinct white band around their neck where they get the name ring-necked pheasant.
Ring-necked pheasants were imported in the late 1800s. They started out in Washington State and then were brought to the Midwest, where they flourished. We locked a male pheasant in the chicken house on our farm one winter, and the next fall had a hen that laid green eggs. Is that how Dr. Seuss got the idea for his children's book, Green Eggs and Ham? You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green about the Y2K computer problem and nuclear power plants. Will the plants shut down or heat up when the millennium arrives? The experts say no. The corn is drying up, but the apple crop may still make it. It's the drought in the Northeast. And a reflection about the environmental ambience of the recent Woodstock Music Festival, Pew. Stay with us. We are talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. By the time the year 2000 actually comes around, it's going to be an anticlimax because there's been so much talk about Y2K and possible computer failures that no one really is going to believe that at 12:01 on New Year's morning, the world will still be functioning. But it will be. And Y2K, of course, is the phenomenon which has been said, if not corrected, could cause computers to shut down because they were originally programmed to think that the year 00 would be 1900 instead of 2000. And a Y2K issue that's had environmentalists concerned relates to nuclear power plants and their safe operation. A recent report from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says that computers controlling safety systems in the 103 nuclear plants around the country are all ready now for the millennium. And so today, we're going to find out what it actually took to get our plants Y2K compliant, and whether the confidence which is being exuded by the regulatory folk and the people that operate plants is actually justified. I have two guests with me. Carl Terry, he is Vice President of Nuclear Safety Assessment and Support for the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation. That's a utility that owns and operates two nuclear plants on the shores of Lake Ontario. And with me here in the studio is John Gibb, and he is Assistant Director for Preparedness with the New York State Emergency Management Office. Carl Terry from Niagara Mohawk, let's start with you. Are indeed your plants ready for the year 2000?
Yes, we are, Peter. Fundamentally, we've just sent in a letter 1st of July or the end of June that certified that to the NRC. It means that the equipment in the plant has been looked at, and it is Y2K ready.
Let me ask you something. As a layman, but with some passing interest in all this stuff, if I drive up to one of your power plants and say, I'm here to make it Y2K compliant, we're talking about the time before you went through all these drills. What is it that has to be done? Take us through the steps very briefly that you go through to make a nuclear power plant compliant to be able to handle the millennium.
Okay, well, the first thing you need to do is determine where your vulnerabilities are. And to do that, we screened numerous components, in fact, about 60,000 of them, just to give you an idea, at our two plants. What we looked for there were any pieces of equipment that might be controlled by computers or had applications that might be controlled by dates. We got that 60,000 component list down fairly readily to about 4,000 components that we had to look at closely, more closely, what we call a more detailed assessment. And that was because we couldn't immediately screen them out using some established criteria like there were no dates or there were no integrated circuits or computer controls in there. From there, we screened that further down to a little over 400 components that actually did require what we refer to in the business as remediation, or basically we had to do some fixes on those components to make them compliant.
And just in brief, that involves what? Taking the computer chip or whatever it is out and reprogramming it? What do you do to make it compliant?
Well, that's one thing we do, where it is what we call an embedded chip or a pre-programmed chip. That's one thing. Or in the case of a number of applications, software applications that most of us are familiar with, there we had to do some reprogramming or possibly replace that software with an application that the developer had made Y2K compliant.
John Gibb from the Department of Emergency Management in the state, you are obviously concerned about these things on a larger basis. What are the safety problems that led your office to be concerned about this to begin with? If a nuclear power plant is not Y2K compliant, and there's no suggestion that they're not, what are the kinds of problems that could arise?
Well, actually, Peter, whether or not it's a Y2K problem or any type of problem that affects a nuclear power plant, we have very complicated and comprehensive plans in place to deal with emergencies that could arise at one of the nuclear power plants. We work very closely on a routine basis with the utilities to make sure our plans are current, to make sure we're looking at the various contingencies that could occur. We exercise those plans. We do a lot of joint training. So we're not focused so much on year 2000 problems as it relates to the nuclear power plants. We're concerned about problems that could happen there today or tomorrow.
And I suppose the thing that the public is ultimately concerned about is something that could happen in the operation of a plant that results in the release of radioactive material. We know a little bit about Three Mile Island, where I guess the thing got too hot and vented steam and so on. What is the kind of nuclear safety problem that is of concern that you obviously are trying to make sure it does not happen?
Well, you're very correct. What we try to achieve is to make sure that there is no radioactive release to the environment. And I think Three Mile Island is an excellent example of the design concepts of nuclear power plants in this country, where there is defense in depth built into the plant engineering. And Three Mile Island, by I think anyone's estimation, was a catastrophic accident, and yet, you know, there was very minimal release of radioactivity to the environment. We work with utilities to make sure that we can expect what type of problems might occur, that those accidents are classified in a way that the utility and we offsite understand, and that we can take appropriate protective actions based on the utility and our analysis of the accident event.
Carl, you said something that I thought was interesting. You said you screened 60,000 systems in these plants to figure out which ones might be affected by the year 2000. How do you find 60,000 systems in a power plant, and how do you figure out where those 4,000 are that you had to look at in further depth?
Well, that's an excellent question. First off, we have a lot of documentation associated with everything in our nuclear plants, which actually did make this job easier. We have a list of components that we could go through. It's actually components. There are fewer than that systems, but actual components was on the order of 60,000. So we went through that list, and we used what we call the screening criteria. And simply put, what that did is it looked for things such as, are there embedded chips in there? Is there either an internal or external clock that's associated or calendar that's associated with that application? Many of those went away because they didn't have any of those kinds of things. And in fact, just as an aside on safety impact directly, all of our safety systems are controlled by essentially relays and switches that aren't vulnerable to year 2000 issues, which makes the safety screen in terms of nuclear power plants fairly straightforward.
Now, explain that to me. Relays and switches, therefore not, is that because there's some human being at the other end that throws a switch?
No, what it is, Peter, is the application itself only has a power to it that is either off or on, and it doesn't have any external controls, a computer controlling it, or anything of that nature. So
it gets too hot and it shuts off, like my coffee pot.
It gets too hot, it shuts off, yeah. I think a good that's an excellent example, just like your toaster. When your toast is done, the switch opens and it shuts the toaster off. And most applications are that kind of a thing. So that fairly readily screened out a lot of them.
I read an article that said that the folk that are really having a problem here with nuclear plants are the Japanese, because their plants are more recently built than, say, yours are, and they may well have chips in them that nobody knows about that are much farther and more frequent and buried deeper in the machinery.
Well, there's some truth to that because of the nature of the nuclear business in this country, most of the plants are, certainly the technology is on the order of 20 years or more old. Particularly the critical systems for the plant because of the licensing process as well as plant construction timeframes that we went through. So we have very, very few computer applications, particularly controlling the plant. Most of our applications are in computers are what we call informational-type computer systems, some for the plant that give the operator information, but they don't control anything. More modern plants in Japan, I believe also in some in France where they've got a more advanced program, there are more, would be a larger screening process like the one I went through in terms of doing it. I would add, though, that I don't believe they've had any problems in terms of solving them. They just have more work to do.
I guess we're talking about other things here, too. There's obviously the safety issue, which you describe. There's also the business of getting the power out on the line, which may not be directly related to the nuclear issue, but certainly has Y2K implications. John Gibb, what is the situation in New York with respect to that? Is that got Y2K problems as well?
Well, utilities in New York State have been under a State Public Service Commission order to be year 2000 ready, have their mission critical systems year 2000 ready by July 1st. Utilities have also been required to have in place contingency plans for their mission critical systems. The PSC is working, the Public Service Commission is working on a weekly basis with the utilities, and right now we have no reason to expect that there'd be widespread long duration interruptions.
Carl, I think you mentioned that you had been testing your system. How do you test a nuclear power plant for Y2K compliance?
Well, essentially what we do whenever we complete any modification on a system, we take it through its paces in terms of actually performing its function. One of the advantages we have in a nuclear plant, again, is we have a lot of redundancy in our systems. In other words, we have dual safety trains, independent systems to detect either problems or take action so that there really isn't any doubt, defense in depth, as John Gibbs referred to it. So what we're able to do then is set up testing of systems. Actually, a lot of it we can do while the plant is in operation, isolating that particular function and running a test. We did do a few things during plant outages, but actually very little of that was required. It does have to be controlled, though. We have procedures that need to be developed, and then walk through the steps to make sure that you don't inadvertently trip the plant offline or cause a problem.
Thinking more recently, we've had some power outages in the Northeast as a result of very hot weather at the end of June and early July. And I've seen some reports that say that if consumers had been cutting back or trying to conserve a little more, some of those could have been avoided. Are the things that consumers should be doing at 12:01 on New Year's Eve to lessen the possibility of any stress on our electrical system? I'm not sure that they'll pay any attention to you, but is there anything on New Year's Eve that the consumer should be thinking about when it comes to maintaining the integrity of our systems?
No, actually, from our standpoint, there really is no difference in that day than otherwise. We will have, for instance, in the case of both our nuclear plant as well as Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation in general, we will have people on staff in the event something unforeseen does happen. As John Gibb mentioned, we have contingency plans in place, which does involve staffing certain locations and being prepared to take action in the unlikely event that something occurs. But the power systems are designed such that if we absolutely needed to do something, we can either reduce power or in worst case situations, eliminate certain loads to take care of the problem.
Sounds like a pretty lousy New Year's Eve for some of your employees sitting around the plant waiting for something that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I would have to admit that's probably one of the biggest things that we need to do, because just to have people available, of course, would disrupt their weekend. And as it works out, as you may know, that happens to be a three-day weekend. So it doesn't always happen at the best of times.
John, I've heard it said that when it comes to disruptions and emergencies, really the electric power industry is in better shape than others anticipating problems of the millennium, because they're used to outages all the time. You have an ice storm, you have this, that, and the other thing, and fixing the thing and getting it going is part of the standard way of doing business. Does that indeed help you as you think about problems for the millennium?
Peter, electrical service is critical, and certainly in a middle of the winter scenario, as we'll have January 1st, it's very important that we have an uninterrupted supply of electricity because of the problems that power outages would create for people out there in the community. But we're working very closely with all our state agencies here in New York, and I know most states have very active year 2000 emergency preparedness efforts where we want to be able to anticipate any type of year 2000 related problem and make sure we have the plans in place that we can quickly respond. So like Carl and his fellow employees at Niagara Mohawk, we'll also be working New Year's Eve and over that weekend at our State Emergency Operations Center here in Albany.
Well, I want to thank you both. My guests have been Carl Terry, Vice President of Nuclear Safety and Assessment and Support for the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation, which operates two nuclear plants, and John Gibb. He's Assistant Director for Preparedness with the New York State Emergency Management Office. We know that you have questions about nuclear safety and Y2K and why that toaster of yours won't be working on New Year's Day, so share them with us. You can call the Environment Show's toll-free number. It's 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman recently declared the state of West Virginia and parts of Kentucky, Ohio, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia drought disaster areas. Many farmers say this year's drought is the worst they've seen in decades. But the Mid-Atlantic region is not the only place where farmers are hurting. Caitlin Kim visited a farm in New York State to see how one farmer is faring during the drought of 1999.
This is our pack house here. And we're packing a new variety of apple called Titamin. And we've picked the largest ones out of here. And you can see they're only just marginally sized.
Peter Tenike is the owner and operator of Indian Ladder Farms in the upstate New York town of Voorheesville. The farm has been a family operation since early this century, and he, like other farmers, is being affected by the drought that has hit the New England and Mid-Atlantic states.
And right now the size of apple for this year is baggy-sized.
Baggy-sized, yep.
And not the big ones like you normally see. So if people wanted to have what are called 100-count apples, we don't have any for this variety. This early in the season, the drought has affected that. Where you would get hurt would be the early apples that we pick the first week in August. They only have a short time to grow, and if it's dry, it's a greater impact than an apple that we're going to pick in October. They've got another 2 months to make up the difference.
So, as primarily a fruit farmer, how have you been affected by this drought?
Well, the early drought we had when we only had a half an inch of rain in June, we made out, I think, pretty good. And that we have the potential for having a normal size crop. But now, the July drought that we've had, which is now since the 4th of July, we haven't had any rain at all, that's starting to really hurt. The fruit size is falling behind now. And as you saw in there, some of them are clearly small. And the others that are small, maybe they'll catch up and maybe they won't.
So we're looking out over your apple crops right now. And they look, you know, pretty green to me.
Yeah.
And I see some, like, I guess some dead grass or something back there. Have you been watering? What have you been doing?
We have about 20 acres out of 100 acres that we can put water on. We have a very deep, well-drained soil. And the roots explore a large volume of soil, so they're down there deep. So they can get moisture deeper in the ground than other crops are capable of doing. And so the trees can take that, although with all that leaf surface, they really give off an enormous amount of moisture a day. Tens and tens of gallons of water come off of each tree each day. And so sooner or later you hit the wall.
Right now, his apple crop hasn't hit the wall. Driving around the farm, Tenike says he's glad to have an apple crop. The drought is only affecting the size of the apples. But Indian Ladder Farms also grows pears, berries, corn, and pumpkins.
Now, while the apples are doing all right, you can see that the pumpkins are having a serious trouble. Let's get out and just take a look at that.
Okay.
Each one of the leaves should be out in a nice flat, like a table, that you could set things on. Completely flat, but as you can see, the leaves are hanging straight down, almost as though they were draped over the top of something. You know, you don't have to be a horticulturist to know a plant that is in serious trouble, as these are right now.
Tenike has 3 acres of pumpkins. He thinks the eventual yield will be half of what it normally is, and that the pumpkins will also be smaller. He does have irrigation to parts of the farm, mostly shallow-rooted apple trees, in addition to well water. But driving and walking around the farm also reveals how the lack of rain is affecting other kinds of vegetation. The dry grass is green in some places, but brittle, or has turned yellow altogether. And the crop that's been hardest hit on the Tenike farm has been corn.
And I take it that's the corn?
Yeah. This is the corn. This is Indian corn, which is a very large species of corn. What we should be seeing here is a fully planted, each row totally full of corn plants, and they should be more than 6 feet high, probably 7 feet high right now. And what we're looking at is a field that has scattered clumps of corn plants, and they've already tasseled out, so they're not going to get any taller than this. And instead of having flat leaves, the leaves are all curled and rolled right up. Let's take a look and see what the corn plants look like. Well, we can see that that the Iracorn has a full complement of kernels in it, but instead of being 12 or 14 inches long, that Iracorn is only going to be 6 inches long. So the traditional Indian corn that you see that you want to hang on your front door is going to have a little short, stubby ear.
So are you looking at a complete wash in your corn crop this year?
I'd say, probably more than half, maybe 70% of the value of what we have in here isn't going to happen this year. You can just see right now that there's nothing that can help this now because of the very nature of the fact that it's only going to have one ear of corn here. Should have another one at least, and that ear is not going to be something that anybody's going to want to have to eat. So I would say more than half of the crop itself is gone.
Unlike other farmers, Penike isn't banking on just one crop, and this diversity may help him survive what is being called the drought of 1999. For the Environment Show, I'm Caitlin Kim.
Woodstock isn't a place, it's a state of mind. So said the organizers of the event before some of the angry crowd of 225,000 began looting and setting fires. As police and organizers try to figure out what went wrong at Woodstock 99, Susan Arbetter, who attended the festival, looks at what happened to the event's environmental legacy.
During the weekend, the subdued irritation among concertgoers over the high cost of food slowly turned into anger over the excessively commercial nature of the event. Everything at Woodstock was pricey. Water, a necessity on the treeless site in 90-degree heat, was $4 a bottle. But there was another issue that piqued the crowd's already growing anxiety. Trash. Although organizers boasted a workforce of more than 450 people to remove the garbage, it was filthy. And the blacktop at the former Griffiss Air Base in central New York only seemed to exacerbate the problem. Piles of waste paper, pools of urine and cigarette butts dotted the landscape of Woodstock 99. Considering the original festival was known as a day in the garden, this event turned that notion into a visual joke. Between the commercialism and the filth, environmental concerns were not a priority at Woodstock, although profits from those $4 bottles of spring water did go to environmental causes. There was a small tent housing environmental not-for-profits on the site and an art project benefiting the Waterkeepers Alliance. But Woodstock itself was anything but green. Instead, it was a monster of consumption. Organizers made sure that their ad hoc city was fed, housed, and otherwise entertained with massive amounts of resources. 330,000 gallons of water were used, 17 million watts of electricity distributed, 425,000 hot dogs served. Now that the crowds at Woodstock 99 have gone home, a massive cleanup effort is underway to be completed by the end of September. But there is an environmental postscript to the festival. As a final tribute to Rome, New York, the host community, organizers have promised to plant 575 sapling trees on and around the festival site. Only time will tell if the young trees will be enough of a salve to appease the city's anger over the riots. For the Environment Show, I'm Susan Arbetter.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. There are environmental problems on beaches, New England farms, and Woodstock, but cheer up. Your local nuclear power plant probably won't blow up on January 1. Order this show, number 502, by calling 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.